You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on Wednesday the 11th of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, we'll learn why Germany has performed a U-turn on its asylum seeker policy and how it could affect the growing continent-wide crisis. My guests George Brock and Mary Dajewski will tell us all on that. Plus, can a news channel have more say than the politicians making the headlines? We'll assess how Fox Business did in its airing of the Republican presidential candidacy debate last night. We'll also ask what the lasting damage of Russia's sporting doping scandal will be for the country and how it should react. And we'll ask why the fact that Vladimir Putin has a family is making the news and whether it should be news at all. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are George Brock, Professor of Journalism at City University here in London, and Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, amongst others. Mary and George, welcome to you both. We begin today with Germany. The country's government has announced a U-turn in the past 24 hours to its much-disputed open-door policy on refugees arriving from Syria. Amid political turmoil that has seen Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats embroiled in internal disputes with their coalition partners about how to deal with the large influx of numbers, Germany has now announced it will revert to the so-called Dublin rules for asylum seekers. It means that refugees and migrants must be sent back to the first country in which they entered the European Union for appraisal of their refugee status. George Brock, I guess in some ways one can be surprised that this relaxation of the rule lasted so long.
There's a way, isn't there, in which politicians who have been around a long time go slightly off the rails or off the reservation as they somewhere get somewhere towards the 10-year mark. It happened with Tony Blair, it happened with Margaret Thatcher in Britain, and Angela Merkel, having been an extremely careful and extremely prudent politician, suddenly does something which absolutely shocks all her colleagues in the German Christian Democrats, their political allies, and indeed, come to that, the rest of the world. And most of the time since she said they can all come to Germany, basically, everybody has been scrambling around, reactions have ricocheted around and so on. And then a few days ago, Wolfgang Schäuble, by a long way the most senior minister in her government and the most powerful individual after her, began to sound like he wasn't fully supporting what she was doing and she was going to have to make some concessions. So at that point, I think it became clear they were going to have to row back. Can I just say one thing, however? You said they turned around on what they'd done. They have made an exception of Greece, and an awful lot of the people reaching Germany are going through Greece. So it's not a complete turnaround.
Mary, before I come to you, George, I just want to pick you up on one thing. Isn't it a little bit unfair to compare Angela Merkel's decision on refugees to Margaret Thatcher going a little bit stir-crazy after 10 years and introducing the poll tax, Tony Blair invading Iraq? I mean, this was an emotional decision, wasn't it, rather than a sort of a megalomaniacal sort of, I have power and I'm deciding to do this thing.
They're not perfect parallels. I'm just noticing that after about a decade, particularly in foreign affairs, people start doing things which really surprise their colleagues, and everybody around the cabinet table goes, what?
Mary, even with this change in policy now, this change in direction, Germany is still accepting huge numbers of refugees compared to elsewhere in Europe. And that's going to remain that way, isn't it? We're still not seeing anywhere else in Europe having any sort of comparable decision to allow refugees, asylum seekers in.
No, that's true. And Sweden, which has had this terrific reputation for being extraordinarily generous proportionate to the level of its population, is also really calling time on the whole thing, partly because of internal opposition, partly because even Sweden doesn't have the capability to process people through the system and integrate them, even sort of in first principles. It's just extraordinarily difficult. difficult. I'd like to go back to this question of Angela Merkel's decision, because I'm not sure even that it was a sort of knee-jerk emotional decision. I think there was some rationale behind it. One of them, obviously, was the abiding reaction to Germany in the 30s and 40s and saying, no, we can never do that again. We've got to present a totally different face to the world. And the second thing was an entirely rational, almost too rational angle, which says that Germany actually has a declining population. It's going to need new people to join the workforce. And if you look at it in raw numbers, then it's not a stupid thing that Angela Merkel was proposing to do. The problem, of course, was with the politics, and not just with her coalition partners and members of her immediate party, but maybe more to the point with her Bavarian sister party, the CSU, which was in extreme high dudgeon, because a lot of the burden of receiving all these refugees, they were coming to the south of Germany. And there was a threat not just to her coalition with the Social Democrats, there was a threat to her coalition in the centre-right, and that would have been just as bad as the apparent dissension from Schäuble.
George, do you think that Merkel expected to get more support from towards her decision, not just internally from people within her own party and the sister party, CSU, but also within the Grand Coalition, but also from throughout Europe as well? Do you think she was hoping at least that some other leaders might step forward and think, well, okay, if Germany's taking the lead, we might be able to join them? Because she has pretty much been left all on her own, hasn't she?
She's a very, very smart politician, and I rather doubt that she kidded herself that people were going to line up behind her. My impression more has been of somebody who, and Mary's explanations of her motives is completely right. My impression has much more been if somebody just said, we're going to do this and we're going to get through it somehow. We're going to have to do it. It's our duty. That's what we've got to do. Okay, there are one or two other self-interested reasons in the background, but, it's also our duty to take a moral lead. I think that is part of the decision. It's not the whole of it. But it has, when you get right down to it, what changes a politician's mind about things? Well, quite often it's opinion polls, and they are sinking in the opinion polls. It's very difficult to lead a party in a democracy and say to your colleagues, I may be perfectly okay, but actually you're going to lose the next election. Bad luck. That really doesn't go over well. And that's what a lot of people in the CDU and the CSU are now starting to look at.
Mary, I do think that she may have hoped that she would have shamed other big European countries into doing something very similar, and immediately to upping the amount of the number of people that they were prepared to take.
And Britain did very generously immediately say, we'll take 20,000
exactly,
over 5 years,
exactly.
Probably we'll think about it, but only from camps, and
but
we'll get around to it.
There's been interesting silence from other places as well, notably France. And if you think of the places that actually could probably be taking more refugees. Yes, there's Britain, and we're in a peculiar position because, of course, of the imminence of the referendum, and there is also the question, the huge question of public opinion here. We're not in Schengen either, so the question of free movement to that extent doesn't arise. But France is a similar size, similar economy. France has been conspicuous, really, by their silence.
You can see the size of her gamble, in a sense. Once upon a time, 10 or 15 years ago, no German leader would have launched this policy without making absolutely sure that Paris was on its side. That doesn't happen any longer.
George, there was another announcement today regarding the issue of refugees, which was that the European Union would essentially pay African governments to keep people in their countries, to help improve economies, is I think what they're trying to say, so that people don't want to leave in the first place. The European Union seems to have stepped away from any sense of the promotion of democracy around the world, and is now far more interested in in essentially propping up governments so long as they'll help us keep their people in their countries.
Well, I'm sure they would claim they're still interested in the promotion of democracy. I mean, what they're trying to do here is put out a fire. And the fire is threatening all sorts of things in the European Union, not to mention the political cohesion of the 28 states that make it up. You know, open borders is a very, very basic principle in the EU. And borders, what has happened to borders in the last few months? Well, a number of them have been shut. So, you know, it's just the most immediate, urgent problem they've got. I don't think they're necessarily pushing other things aside. They're just trying to solve the biggest problem they have.
I think there's another problem, too, in paying African governments to help with their economies and keep people in the country. Because, as I understand it, the argument is actually it's not the very, very poorest who are on the move. It's the people whose lives have actually improved to the point where they are aware that there are other countries out there where there are much better prospects. And they are not the absolute poorest of the poor. They're people with a degree of education and ambition. And I don't think that paying African economies to improve themselves to keep people at home is actually going to have that effect. It could have the reverse effect.
And it's certainly not going to have any impact on a country like Eritrea, where people are leaving for very good reasons because it's a brutal dictatorship. George, what happens from here? Because if Angela Merkel, of all people, has decided that actually there is a limit to, if we can term it, Europe's generosity, you know, even though that's kind of pushing it, if she says there's a limit to that, what happens next? Because this flow is not stopping, is it?
No, it isn't. No, it doesn't look like it is. I mean, every sign is that even though winter is coming, they're still trying to cross the sea and the land and everything else. I mean, I think they will end up in Germany. Whatever they do, whatever steps they may just have taken, or whatever steps they might take in the next week or two, they're going to end up with enormous reception centres at the southern end of the country. They're going to have a huge management problem. It's going to cost them a very large amount of money. And, you know, they're going to have a very hard difficulty, and they may not make any progress, I'm talking about Germany here, in persuading other people to take more. There's no easy fix to any of this that I can see.
I think there's a couple of very immediate dangers. One of them is that as soon as the weather deteriorates even more, we're going to have horrific pictures of people, you know, as there were with Kosovo, of people sort of stranded over mountains and in totally inhospitable terrain. The other thing is that there could be a sort of backup of huge numbers of people, especially in the Balkans, which is already not exactly the most stable part of the world. So I think things do not look good, whatever happens on the German border.
Okay, let's move on. Last night, those vying for the Republican Party presidential candidacy went head-to-head again in the US. This time the debate aired on Fox Business, the conservative-aligned broadcasting minnow, relatively anyway, still owned by that media whale that is Rupert Murdoch, compared certainly to the rival CNBC, which aired the last one. The tone of debate has been commended for offering more substantive tone, but has also been criticised for keeping the themes firmly in Fox Business's financial territory. So should a TV channel have this much influence over the tone of how politics is discussed in the US? George Brock, I mean, I guess in some ways, if this is the channel that's hosting it, they should decide exactly what theme it should be.
Yeah, I mean, I can't see how you can have a system which is different from a channel negotiating with, I mean, spare a thought for the people at these American channels who have to do these negotiations. They're having to do it with 8 or 10. One of them was 10 candidates. I think this one was only 8. That must be quite a migraine-inducing business. And they've got to cut deals about how it's going to be done. Personally, I think if it's on a business channel, it's not entirely surprising. It's mostly about business and economics. It's kind of there in the channel's title. And secondly, we already know from earlier Republican debates and plenty of other events on TV that, you know, those kinds of politicians are really good at kind of short-term, sparky, superficial, insult-swapping debates. I didn't watch very much of this debate, but as far as I can see, you know, they actually allowed people to explain what they were doing, which is a technique otherwise known in journalism of giving people enough rope to hang themselves. It's quite often quite revelatory. It's not necessarily weak or soft. There are different ways of getting the most interesting and indeed in some ways, the, you know, making them more vulnerable politicians. It's not necessarily hammering questions at them and interrupting them all the time, or allowing them to interrupt each other.
Mary, of course, the context to this is that the last debate, which CNBC moderated, was mainly filled with the candidates slagging off the media and the moderators, and actually, if we're going to be honest, some pretty bad, poorly prepared moderators who didn't have good follow-ups, who couldn't actually say where their facts had come from. And it had led to a bit of a fight, hadn't it, between the candidates and the media over what these debates should be about. Do you agree with George that it's right that some of this that there should be a sort of a shifting back to the journalists that are asking the questions as to what these debates are about?
Well, I think there are a lot of things to object to about money in American politics, but I think probably a small channel like Fox Business hosting a Republican election debate way before the conventions, way before the actual election, I really don't have any problem with that. One of the interesting things that I saw in the reporting of this was the huge compliments actually paid to the moderator this time around. And the interesting thing here is that, yes, it was somebody from, as it were, the Murdoch stable. But Gerard Baker, who is the editor-in-chief of the Wall Street Journal, actually has an enormous pedigree coming back to the UK, and he cut his teeth on the Financial Times and was bureau chief for them in the United States. So that I suspect that the sort of, you know, the British manner, which I'm sure he retains, that still works its charm to a degree in the United States.
That's good to know.
It's very reassuring, isn't it? But it also, I think, maybe the sort of calmer, less frenetic manner that he would bring to this, plus, of course, the expertise in that particular area, that can only be a good thing. And I think the more people actually who host debates and the wider the variety, the better, really, because that gives the American voters a very broad idea of the candidates as they have in front of them.
George, there was during the last election in 2012, there was a lot of commentary about who was asking the questions and whether they were right, whether they were any good. And there was Republican criticism of Candy Crawley, who's the CNN moderator, after she fact-checked Mitt Romney in the midst of the debate. Journalists have been, it's fair to say, over the past few years, slightly cowed by standing up to politicians in the US. You're making a face if that's perhaps not true, but I mean, don't you think?
I think politicians are routinely aggressive with people who try to take them down in public, and it's not surprising that they are. And if you want to try and play that kind of game with a politician, you really have got to know your subject backwards, forwards, and every single which way. I don't think necessarily, but I think the more important point is that trading blows with politicians on network TV is not necessarily the best way to find out what a politician really thinks. Are their views reasoned through in depth? What do they really mean by them? What will they actually do in practice? And all these kind of rather boring but important questions that voters tend to need to and ought to know about. Sometimes a relentless assault will get you somewhere, but quite often it won't. And quieter, slower, giving them a bit more time to explain themselves, giving the ideas a little bit more exposure so you can get at the bits, points which might be weak or might need further exploration, is a better way of doing it, which it seems to me is roughly what they're doing here.
Okay, we'll leave it there. George Brock and Mary Dzhevsky, thank you both very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment.
Home to Fiat, Turin prided itself on being Italy's manufacturing powerhouse, but global competition put the brakes on the city's economy. Monocle Films witnesses how the Reggio Parco neighbourhood is making use of empty industrial spaces to create a new independent vibe.
Turin in the 70s was made out of little shops in which people used to work on their passions. This area of Turin is a small town in which everyone knows each other, everyone's friends. It started out as a meeting point for friends, and now it became already a meeting point for the whole neighbourhood.
Reggio Parco, Monocle's latest property prospectus film, premiering now on monocle.com.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, George Brock and Mary Dajewski. Now, it's been a story of state-sponsored doping, of urine samples being destroyed, and the world clearly, Mary Dajewski, just ganging up on Russia in the way it always does. At least that's what I read in some of the Russian press this morning. I say that, actually, a lot of the Russian press didn't really cover this story that much. It wasn't on most of the front pages that I saw. So far, what's your take, Mary, on how Russia has been responding to this story?
I think there've been two very different responses. And in a way, that's quite heartening, because the first response was the absolutely standard Soviet-era response. As you say, they're all ganging up on us, nothing to do with us. We don't do anything that that other people don't do. They've just got it in for Russia. But then, within about 24 hours, there was quite a different response, and a much more considered response, from somebody high up in the athletics establishment in Russia, who said, "Well, actually, we do have a problem here, and we recognise that we've got a problem, and actually, for the last year, we've been trying to do something about it." And he said, "The genuine problem is that it's a very, Russia is a huge country. There are a lot of regional organisations, and it takes a long time both to catch up and to get the word out." And I think there is quite a bit of truth in what he says. But I think more interesting is the fact that he said it at all and actually entertained the criticisms that had been made. And I think if Russia does accept that its operations aren't perfect, then that's at least a start.
George Brock, it's been fascinating watching this and seeing how, while to outsiders this looks outrageous, and indeed, the head of the World Anti-Doping Association, WADA, has said it's outrageous. The punishments that they're talking about seem minuscule. They're like, well, we might suspend them for a few months, but they should be back by the Olympics. We should give them a chance to put their house in order.
Well, if I understood it right, there is a threat that they might not be able to compete at the Rio Olympics and another major event in the next few years. I mean, it really depends on how far the bans go. And there is certainly a school of thought that believes that the top end of a ban by a big international organization ought to be 4 years and not two. Roughly speaking, at the moment, the maximum tends to be two. That's for individual athletes. But I think the tariff is roughly the same for associations. If you make it 4 years, then you really do make it extremely difficult for sponsors, for example, to back teams which are very necessary to Olympic things. And I think the scale of what is going on, because while as Mary rightly observes, I mean, every old propaganda technique you've ever heard of is being used by Russian spokesmen to try and kind of blur and spread around this and so on. They aren't wrong when they observe that even WADA said there are other countries about this, and some very senior people have said, look, there are five or six countries where we have very serious problems. Somebody has mentioned Kenya, there have been various others and so on. So by the time all this unravels, don't forget, if you go back to the FIFA scandal, everything doesn't come out in one go. It's not that neat. There are probably going to be several months over which there is going to be whole new tranches of revelation. And we haven't even got the whole of the WADA report yet, I don't think.
No, one chapter's been held back.
So, it's all going to come out in bits. Now, by the time they've got all that, then you may have racked up really quite a lot, because people will have realised just exactly how serious it is. And there might be quite a number of countries not at the next Olympics.
George just mentioned FIFA then, and if we didn't have lawyers who are sort of listening to this, I could probably mention a few other international sporting organisations that might have some questions to answer. What is it about international sporting organisations?
Well, I think they're, and this is to make an extremely broad generalisation, which will
broad
no doubt be attacked.
Are fine.
They appear to be very secure, very complacent, and extremely untransparent organisations, where the information available is where other organisations, in particular governments, have generally become more transparent and have had to become more transparent because of the demands from journalists and from their own voters and populations, the people who are paying the taxes. With sporting organisations, that tends not to happen. And it's extremely difficult for people to get hold of absolutely genuine, authoritative information. And that will often depend on people who are whistleblowers. They know that they're going to get into trouble. The value of their information may have questions over it, and it needs verification. It's just extremely difficult to find real information.
And George, I mean, if you even just look at where these places are based now, the IAAF in Monaco, FIFA in Zurich, the ICC, the International Cricket Council, now in Dubai, it's, you know, They don't make it easy for people to want to cover them, for journalists to want to cover them, to have an aura of transparency.
No, they don't. But I think when you are trying to reform, or even very difficult to reform organisations of this kind, there are two different things you have to look at. You need rules and you need transparency and all of the things that Mary was rightly describing just now. And the rules have got to really bear down on the important things. But also you do get moments where culture changes, where people start to realise that actually the attitudes of the past simply won't do. And I think the factor that we're not yet looking at, because they tend to be very quiet when these scandals break, are the big sponsors of big sporting events. Now, if you were thinking of sponsoring the next Olympics, or indeed if you're already signed up to sponsor the next Olympics, are you really going to want to sponsor the weightlifting? Are you going to want to sponsor the middle distance running for women? I don't think you would. Now, that will, in the end, have quite a big leverage. It'll have quite a big influence on what happens. It may not be immediate. It's not going to be tomorrow. These are big corporations. They move quite slowly. They don't decide things overnight. But if money starts flowing out of the system, then all of that kind of whining and dining that goes on in Dubai and Zurich and wherever else, the money that flows into it is smaller. That's a real difference.
The freedom fighter standing up for the little guy is Coca-Cola. let's finally, we're going to head back to Russia to talk about the alleged reports that the country's leader, wait for it, has a daughter. Now, it's perhaps not exactly a bombshell, but Vladimir Putin's family life is intensely guarded, and the recent revelation of the identity of one of his offspring has hit the headlines. And Mary, it's perhaps not just because of who she is, but the fact that Katerina Tikhonova, I hope I'm saying that right, appears to be a billionaire. Fancy that, eh?
Well, I wouldn't put it quite like that. It's been, I think it's always been known that Putin has two daughters. Beyond that, almost nothing has been known. So anything that anybody finds out, obviously, is gold dust. And these latest reports say that it's his younger daughter, Katerina, who all this fuss is about. And billionaire, as I understand it, not in her own right, but from her husband, who was in banking or something, something sort of equally dubious in those times in Russia. And they've got a property portfolio that includes a penthouse in Biarritz and there's all sorts of other things and investments around the place. It's not clear to me whether the money is actually liquid or not, or whether it's just whether it's invested, or that's not clear. She's also said to hold some inexplicable posts at Moscow State University. It's very hard to gauge how much of this, if any of it, is true. The other daughter, there's almost nothing known about her. I think I saw one report that said that she also had an association with Moscow State University, but she was medically qualified and was a researcher in the area, I think, of endocrinology was what was said. If you're talking about keeping your family's private life private, then you have to say that Putin's done a pretty good job.
He has indeed. George, I'm afraid we're out of time for your thoughts on this. Sorry.
Perfectly okay.
Well, I can't leave it there. George Brock, Mojejevsky, thank you both very much indeed. That's all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jamie Waters. The studio manager was Kieran Benaggi. Then for the next half hour, Josh Fenitz will be here with Monocle's International Playlist. Then it's The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli. That's at 1900. Midori House is back at the same time again tomorrow. That's 1800 here in London. That's 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.